Today on Crossing the Line, we spend the program talking to Nadia Hijab, Senior Fellow at the Washington Office of the Institute for Palestine Studies, and the author of Citizens Apart, A Portrait of Palestinians in Israel. Also, a brief wrap-up on the news from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, plus Biden numbers. All this straight ahead. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Christopher Brown, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. On Monday, December 4th, the Israeli army killed a Palestinian during an arrest raid in the West Bank. After nightfall Monday, Israeli troops opened fire at two men in the West Bank town of Tol Karem, killing one, the army reported. The other man, who was the target of the arrest raid, was wounded and captured. However, Palestinian security officials said the soldiers opened fire at a restaurant, killing a civilian and wounding two others, the militant and a teenager. Also on Monday, Israeli soldiers in the West Bank town of Nablus killed 15-year-old Jamil Jabaji on the edge of Nablus's Askar refugee camp while throwing stones at an Israeli jeep. An army spokesman confirmed the shooting of a stone thrower near the refugee camp. Quote, Palestinians hurled rocks at the soldiers who responded by firing at one of the leaders of the stone throwers. Unquote. On Tuesday, December 6th, the Israeli military arrested 29 Palestinians in the West Bank. An Israeli spokesman said the majority of those arrested are suspected of membership in armed groups, including the ruling Hamas movement and a group loosely linked with President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah party. All of this comes in the midst of a tenuous ceasefire that took hold in the Gaza Strip less than 2 weeks ago. Since the start of Operation Summer Rain and the capture of Corporal Gilad Shalit, over 400 Palestinians, about a quarter of them children, have lost their lives. Thousands of Palestinians have been displaced from their homes. Food, drinking water, medical supplies, and the economic blockade of funds to the Palestinian Authority have put the Gaza Strip on the verge of collapse. Although the ceasefire agreement does not cover the West Bank, militants in Gaza have repeatedly threatened to break the truce and launch a wave of reprisal attacks because of Israeli military operations there. Joining me to talk more about the ongoing catastrophe in the West Bank and Gaza Strip is Nadia Hijab. Nadia is a senior fellow and co-director of the Washington Office for the Institute for Palestine Studies and currently on the advisory board of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. Nadia Hijab, welcome to Crossing the Line.
Thanks for inviting me.
Nadia, could you talk more about the current situation in Gaza at the moment?
Well, I think you summed it up really well in your introduction. Perhaps the worst thing is that the ceasefire in Gaza is presented as a major accomplishment, whereas Palestinians in the West Bank, it's still open season on them. And when the Gazans fire rockets at Israel, as they have done a few times after the ceasefire in response to Israeli attacks on the West Bank, the Israelis can claim that Palestinians are violating the ceasefire. It makes a nonsense of, the ceasefire sort of makes a nonsense of the fact that there is a Palestinian people and it is connected, even though Israel has come between them.
Now, Nadia, it's good that you brought up this ceasefire because recently Gideon Levy, a correspondent for Haaretz newspaper, wrote an article about the outcome of the ceasefire. And I want to read a little bit of that to you. He is quoted as saying in his article, "Here is the forecast. In a few days, there will be a targeted killing operation. The military correspondents will recite, 'He was one of the senior operatives of Hamas or Islamic Jihad and was responsible for producing and smuggling large amounts of armaments. In response, a barrage of Qassams will fall on Sidrat. One of the residents might be injured. In the process of the targeted killing operations, some passersby might also be killed.' The correspondents will then recite, 'They were armed. Several days later, there might be a terror attack. The leaders of the right-wing parties and the Labor Party will be interviewed on television and will recite, Abu Mazen has once again demonstrated that he is incapable and unwilling to fight terror. There is no one to talk to.'" Nadia, is this a potential likely outcome of this ceasefire?
I think so, because he's what Gideon Levy, who's a terrific correspondent, and I think everyone should read him every day to really understand what's going on. What he's described is something that has been happening regularly over the past several years, that any time there is a truce or a ceasefire or the Palestinians are working towards a unity government or there's some movement on the peace process, then there's an armed attack by the Israelis that blows it up. That's been very well documented by an American Jewish writer, actually called Steve Neva, who monitored Sharon, former Israeli Prime Minister Sharon's actions when he came to power and in the early years of, the 2000, after 2001. And so every time there was a truce or something was reached, the orders were given to assassinate a leader, and the fighting resumed. And this is basically to cover up the ongoing settlement enterprise in the West Bank. The world was very happy when Israel pulled out of Gaza, although Gaza has remained basically under siege since then, in August 2005. But that really was to cement its hold on the West Bank, where the Palestinians remain trapped within very small enclaves, and they're unable to move from towns, between towns and villages, and Palestinians in the West Bank can't even get to East Jerusalem. So that's the situation. I mean, there is a horrible humanitarian crisis in Gaza today, which you've described some of. And it's interesting that the United Nations, 12 UN agencies with 14 non-governmental organizations, have launched the third largest appeal for funds ever made for humanitarian relief for the Palestinians for next year. The humanitarian situation is especially dire in Gaza, but the colonization project is underway in the West Bank.
That is the voice of Nadia Hijab, the senior fellow at the Palestine Institute. Nadia, I want to bring up something that happened last week. I was speaking with Professor Ilan Pape, a revisionist historian at the University of, at the Haifa University. And we were talking about boycotts, as well as academic and cultural boycotts. And he is a strong advocate, as you know, of said boycotts. Do you think that right now is the time to present boycotts on Israel to get their attention? It doesn't seem like anything else is really getting their attention at all.
Yeah, I would agree, because it's... everybody knows what the outlines of a just solution in today's world would be. I mean, the Palestinians wouldn't see it as absolute justice, because they consider that Israel was established in their homeland, Palestine. But a majority of Palestinians have said they're willing to accept a state in the West Bank and Gaza, and East Jerusalem, which is 22% of historic Palestine, in exchange for a final comprehensive peace. And actually, all the Arabs have said, the Arab states have said that they would accept that as a peace agreement with Israel. But Israel has made it very clear that it wants Palestinian land. It doesn't really want peace. It wants to engulf a majority of the West Bank. And it continues to practice what Ilan Pape has described and others have described as ethnic cleansing. Now it's targeting Palestinian sort of professionals, because Palestinians who are married to Palestinians or foreigners who hold foreign passports or foreigners are not allowed to keep their spouses in the West Bank, and Israel is not extending the visas of these spouses for Palestinians. About 120,000 Palestinians have requested reunification permission. I mean, can you imagine a situation where in your own country you have to request permission from the occupying power to reunify your family? And they're not being given that. And so a lot of them have stayed in the West Bank on three-month visas. And Israel has now said that it's not going to renew those. And I just got a letter from a friend whose brother, also a friend, his wife is Swiss, they're Palestinians, they both have ID cards. The Palestinian Swiss wife has been told that she has to leave the country, leave her husband, and go back to Switzerland. So families are being broken up all the time. The policy of ethnic cleansing, or emptying the land from the people so that Israel can take the land without the people, continues. So yes, definitely, I think you need to move to something that is a very positive way to solve a conflict. I think military ways of solving conflicts are extremely, often don't solve conflicts and are extremely harmful. I'm against the use of violence. But economic ways, including boycotts of solving a conflict, of saying, look, we believe that this is wrong and we're going to back up our belief by taking action, by calling for divestment from Israeli companies or companies that support Israel's colonization of the West Bank, by boycotting Israeli goods, you know, or by convincing governments to impose sanctions on Israel. And it's not against Israel. It's against Israel's occupation of a land that does not belong to it. You know, I think that's the only option that's left for people who believe in peace and justice today.
Now, Nadia, playing devil's advocate for a minute here, I agree with you in regards to the boycotts would be a very effective way. Myself, I grew up in South Africa. I understood that the boycotts were a very strategic and brilliant way that we could bring about change within our country. However, as you and I both well know, one of the cries that we are going to hear repeatedly when the boycotts are seriously pursued, as they are right now, vis-a-vis the Presbyterian Church, who is looking into divestment, as well as the academics in Ireland, as well as the teachers' union in Canada, another teachers' union in Britain, the refrain always is, well, this is nothing more than anti-Semitism. You are against Israel. You are just doing this to go ahead and punish the Israeli people. What's the response that we have towards that?
Well, you know, there's several things that we can respond. One is that many Jews, Israeli Jews and American Jews, and actually British Jews and Jews around the world believe that Israel should not be colonizing Palestinian land, and they themselves are calling for boycotts. One of the two people who launched a boycott of Israeli academics in Britain are both Jewish. A major group here in the United States called Jewish Voice for Peace is one of the main movers behind the demand that Caterpillar stop selling bulldozers to Israel. And that's a major campaign that they've launched in collaboration with other groups now that has become a major campaign of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. So many of the people who are calling for boycott or working to stop sort of investment in Israel are themselves Jewish. Many of these groups repeatedly affirm that it is not against Israel, it's against Israel's occupation, and that their focus is on, for example, the academic boycott. The focus is on universities that have ties with the settlement enterprise, you know, primarily, and on academics and universities that do not condemn Israel's occupation. So there's ways of making it very clear that what is targeted is not Israel, it's Israel's occupation.
That is the voice of Nadia Hijab, author of Citizens Apart, A Portrait of Palestinians in Israel. Nadia, recently, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation issued report cards of Congress concerning Israel-Palestine policies and resolutions that have been passed or are currently now being looked at to be implemented. Here in my home state of California, only Maxine Waters, Barbara Lee, and Pete Stark managed to get positive report cards. In many other states, only a few members of the House fared any better or maybe even less, but still with a positive range. Could you talk briefly about these report cards and what it says about this country right at the moment?
Well, there's very little debate in this country about what's really going on in the Middle East. And there's very little information. And I think what congressmen and women respond to is demands from their constituents. So far, the major demands that they're hearing are from constituents that support Israel. They're not hearing an equivalent call from constituents that support a just and comprehensive peace. So if these congressional representatives begin to hear such calls, they will change their position. But until and unless they do, you know, they won't act. And people tend to speak very often about the power of the pro-Israel lobby in this country. And it's true that the pro-Israel lobby is very powerful, but at the same time, representatives have to listen to their constituents. And I think if and when you see a movement in the United States of people concerned about justice in that region, then you'll begin to see a different picture in Congress. Now, I think there is the beginnings of an understanding or more understanding of what's going on due to the Iraq war, because a lot of people make the link between the war in Iraq and the lack of resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And that link was most recently made in the Iraq Study Group report issued, led by Baker and Hamilton. So there is a growing awareness of what's going on, and that will eventually, over time, I think, translate into a shift in policy and a shift in leadership. Meanwhile, tragically, people continue to die on the ground.
Nadia, there's been a recent book that has been written by former President Jimmy Carter, and it's entitled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. I wanted to read just a quick quote. He said, "Israel's continued control and colonization of Palestinian land has been the primary obstacles of a comprehensive peace agreement in the Holy Land." Now, with this book coming out from a noted former head of state and the recommendation of the Baker-Hamilton Commission that the White House include the Israeli-Palestine question into a new approach on Iraq, might we be seeing a potential change on policy towards Israel, or is this more of just glad-handing and showing that, you know, well, we are concerned about the Palestinians and this whole issue of land and their self-determination?
Well, I don't think we'll be seeing a policy shift in the near future, unfortunately, because I think it takes a long time to shift the debate, to create understanding, and then to translate that understanding into political power or a policy shift. So what Carter's book does is contribute to that growing understanding and growing debate, and similarly the Baker Hamilton report does that. What's interesting for me is that these same people, when they were in power, did not act differently. Carter focused primarily on getting a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt, which actually in many ways made it possible for Israel to adopt a unilateral approach to what's going on in Palestine and towards Syria and Lebanon. So because it took Egypt out of the equation. And at the time, what was envisaged in the Camp David Accords that Carter worked on was autonomy for the Palestinians rather than freedom and self-determination. It's quite commendable that Carter has laid his neck on the line, really, and is willing to take the flak that he's willing to take for the book. And perhaps the most important thing about his book is the use of the term apartheid in the title, because more and more people working for justice or activists working for justice on this issue have begun to use this term. And the use of that term makes a link between policies that everyone, that people should find repugnant, and the use of tactics like boycott or sanctions to retaliate against those policies. So I think that's the impact that book will have.
Finally, Nadia, how can more people get involved with the work of the Israel-Palestine conflict? It seems that now they're starting to become more of an awareness that Israel's classic policy of what they're doing is getting exposed more and more, not only within the UN, but also just in general in the world. How can people, especially in this country, in the United States, how can they get more involved in tackling this issue?
Well, I mean, I think the first step is really to get informed, and people can find books and publications, for example, from the Institute for Palestine Studies by going to its website, palestine-studies.org. They can find a very good articles and reports on current events by going to electronicintifada.net. They can also go to for current affairs to Institute for Middle East Understanding, which I believe is imeu.org. So the first thing is to get informed and stay informed. Haaretz, actually, in the Israeli paper you mentioned, often carries some very, very good articles and analysis on the issues. In fact, there's much more of a debate in the Israeli press than there is here in the United States. And then once people get informed, then they can join any number of groups to work for change. They can join Jewish peace groups. They can join Christian peace groups. They can join human rights organizations. A list of such groupings can be found on the website of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, which is endtheoccupation.org. I think people need to get much more informed about United States foreign policy in general and to learn what their country is doing or is not doing in their name. For example, the reason Israel is able to do what it does is because of the economic and political support it gets from the United States, about $3 billion a year in military and economic aid, and also U.S. support for it at the United Nations through the use of the U.S. veto. So that's just as regards the Israeli-Arab conflict, but then there's other U.S. foreign policy that is worrisome, like the decision to invade Iraq, I mean, which is in violation of international law. And Americans need to know that and need to understand what they can do about their country's foreign policy. As regards Iraq, they can look to United for Peace and Justice and its 1,400 member groups to see what they can do about that policy.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, even though I enjoy this conversation richly. You've been listening to the voice of Nadia Hijab, a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies in Washington, D.C., and also the author of Citizens Apart, A Portrait of Palestinians in Israel. Nadia, I want to thank you so much for being on Crossing the Line.
Thanks, Chris. Good talking to you.
And now, by the numbers. $150,000, the amount the Alaska Zoo paid last year to build a treadmill for an 8,000-pound elephant. Zero, the number of times the elephant has used the treadmill so far. Three, the factor by which the jobless rate among veterans under 25 of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars exceeds the U.S. average. Plus 54, the percentage change since 2004 in the number of Army recruits admitted, despite records of serious criminal misconduct. 109, the energy in megawatt hours saved over 35 years by a bicycle rider who does not drive a car. 33, the percentage of Americans in July who said the U.S. had a responsibility to try to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And finally, 5,560, the number of Palestinians and Israeli civilians killed since the start of the Second Intifada in September 2000. In Berkeley, this is Christopher Brown for Crossing the Line.